Shazia Ahmed, and you're listening to Window Islam.
People of the world, do you know the truth about Islam? Or do you think it's about bombing planes and killing innocent people? Forget about the lies. I'm here to tell you how it really is. You deserve to know the truth about this beautiful way of life. People of the world, Islam is all about peace. Terrorism, it doesn't teach. It's all about love and family and charity and praying to one God. This is Islam. It's something you should know. I know it's really helped me grow. It does away with greed, filth, arrogance, and teaches us morality.
Assalamu alaikum, peace be with you. I'm Shazia Ahmed, and this is Window on Islam. Our topic today is understanding Islamic law. Sharia, or Islamic law, guides Muslims' everyday lives and is central to Muslim identity and practice. As Islam makes no distinction between spiritual and mundane activities in life, both seen as means by which to worship God, the Sharia addresses and governs both aspects of life. In popular media today, the term Sharia has become somewhat synonymous with inflexible authoritarian systems. Its implementation is often defined as one of the dangerous objectives of Islamist radicals. Today, we'd like to discuss and understand more about Sharia, its purpose, objective, application, and relevance. You can listen to this and other editions of Window on Islam on our website, www.windowonislam.com. If any of our listeners out there have any questions or comments during the program, please feel free to call into the studio. Our phone number here is area code 518-276-6248. And for our online listeners, feel free to instant message us. Our AOL screen name is WRPI Studio. Our guest with us today is Dr. Ingrid Mattson. Dr. Mattson was born in Canada, where she studied philosophy at the University of Waterloo, Ontario. Dr. Mattson, PhD, from the University of Chicago in 1999. In 2001, Dr. Mattson was elected Vice President of the Islamic Society. She is currently the Director of Islamic Chaplaincy and a professor at the McDonald Center for Islamic Studies and Christian-Muslim Relations at Hartford Seminary in Hartford, Connecticut. Dr. Mattson, thank you for being with us on the program.
Oh, you're welcome, Shazia. It's nice to be here.
Just to start out, I was wondering if you could give us a very general definition of the Sharia, where it comes from, what it means when someone says Sharia.
Well, literally, the word Sharia in the Arabic language means the path to the watering hole, to the pond. So the implication of that word is that the Sharia is a way of understanding morality and law that is divine, that the divine law is the source of life for all people and, in fact, for the world itself, just as water is necessary for life, so the divine guidance is necessary for life and for a healthy and good life for all creatures. Mm-hmm. That's the literal meaning, and from that is derived the idea, the usage, the technical usage of the word Sharia to encompass, the whole approach to law that Muslims take. It's misunderstood often to mean positive law or the actual rules and regulations that are derived by scholars, but in fact that's incorrect. The the term is much more than that.
So it's not one specific document or text?
That's right. The Sharia is the approach to seeking the law. And that is based, Muslims base their approach on a number of texts. The revealed book to the Muhammad, which is called the Quran, the holy book of Islam. And then also the Sunnah, which means the way, or the example of, in particular, the example of the Prophet Muhammad. So that includes directions that he gave to his followers, laws, principles, morality, and really it's in that derivation that is the formation of law, because these sources themselves, the Quran and the Sunnah, are not law in themselves. They're not law books, but there's a law. It's law, really, in Sharia that is, in fact, reflective of what God would like us to do in this life.
Mm-hmm. Are these rules specific just to spiritual practices in the religion of Islam and just religious rituals, or is it also encompassing other aspects of life?
Yeah. No, the Sharia encompasses really all of life, so that it includes both the acts of worship, ritual acts, which are called ibadat, and then also the actions and spheres of life that are related to interactions between human beings, civil transactions called mu'amalat. So that includes things like inheritance and buying and selling, and all the different other aspects of law that we're used to. But there's a very important point here that we need to make, which is that although Sharia encompasses all these different aspects of life, that doesn't necessarily mean that the government, that the Islamic State, has jurisdiction over all of these matters in terms of being able to enforce behavior in all of these areas.
Mm-hmm.
Some parts of the Sharia are what we would understand in American society to be more ethical guidelines or moral imperatives, and others are other aspects are in fact laws that the state would regulate.
Mm-hmm. That's really interesting. That actually leads me to my next question, which is, you talked about how Sharia is not simply the Quran or the teachings of the Prophet Muhammad, but it's actually interpretation and deriving law from these things. So my question is, who exactly derives and interprets these things? Because we know a really interesting feature of Islam is that there's no formal clergy. So who is it that has the authority to go in and derive and interpret things?
Well, that's the key question. I think it's a key question now for Muslims, and really throughout history it has been. I think if before I answer that question in the contemporary period, I'd like to take you back a little bit historically, and point out that over the centuries, it was clear that those pious people and those scholars who spent their lives studying the law were always a little bit skeptical of the state and a little bit skeptical of politics. And so what we saw, although it's sort of a truism that there's no separation of church and state in Islam, that in fact in Islamic society it wasn't necessarily the case. It doesn't mean that there was a separation of church and state, but certainly there were there was a sphere of scholarship that was apart from the state, that was independent, and the people who studied the law, the scholars, like in the rabbinical tradition, established their own institutions, usually funded by private endowments, charitable endowments, so that they could keep their activities of interpreting the law and deriving new laws as far away from direct political interference by the government. Now, that doesn't mean that at various times throughout history that tension between the state and the scholars wasn't intensified, or that sometimes, you know, certain groups of scholars or classes weren't co-opted into the state. And certainly if they wanted to, if the scholars wanted to influence society at large, then they needed to cooperate to some extent with the government, and it was from their ranks that judges were chosen. But to have that independent sphere of scholarship was very important, just as in American society, lawyers go to law schools that are, may, you know, have some relationship with government institutions and government support, yet they're independent in the sense of that there's academic freedom for the, you know, law professors and other people to interpret and reinterpret the law.
Mm-hmm. In the sphere of scholars that you mentioned, was there room for differences of opinion and interpretation, or was it that they all came to an agreement on one specific interpretation?
No, certainly. Obviously, there are different schools of thought in Islamic law, and one of the biggest differences is between the Shiite and the Sunni scholars. But even among the Sunni scholars, for example, there are many, many different schools of law. Most of the schools of law in the very early period of Islam were small, just different ways of thinking or interpreting law. But within a few centuries, four main schools of law developed, and they were distinguished by, more than anything, slightly different methodology. So if you remember at the beginning, I was speaking about the importance of interpreting the sacred sources, and what these four different schools did was to derive slightly different methodologies at how they would interpret these sources of law. But what they came up with were not radically different approaches to the law, but slightly different variations, and in general these schools developed regionally, so they also, the different schools incorporated different aspects of culture and society, mm-hmm. In which they practiced. And they, by and large, recognized each other as legitimate sources of law, even as they had their differences.
Mm-hmm. We know that the Muslim world actually spread from China to well into Europe, so there definitely was diverse geographic and social and cultural contexts in which Muslims lived. So would you say that the Sharia is adaptive to different cultures and different times?
Well, very much so. In fact, the Muslim scholars of the law all recognized that custom, local custom, was a source of law in the absence of any specific revelation on the topic. And in fact, that meant that a very wide area of life was governed according to custom. There's a scholar, Lawrence Rosen, who teaches Islamic law at Princeton and Columbia University, who's in fact, after doing a comparison of how Islamic law works in practice compared with other world legal systems, said that Islamic law is best conceived of as a common law system, in that to a great extent it is the local norms and practices that are that the law seeks to support community life, at the same time that there's an underlying universal ethical approach and some rules that apply across the Muslim world.
I find it so interesting that the Sharia can be implemented in all these different types of societies and cultures. So I was wondering, maybe you could elaborate on that a little bit more about the principles that underlie it, because just considering that this body of law, or this system of law, is something that has been implemented for the past 1,400 years all over the Muslim world, when there's such differences there, I mean, that's something that personally I find really interesting. So could you talk maybe a little bit about the basic principles that are universal to all the different implementations of Sharia?
Well, one of the approaches that many of the Muslim scholars traditionally take is an inductive understanding of the principles of Islamic law. What I mean by that is that the scholars, after deep study of the Quran and of the Sunnah and of other derived sources of law, came to the conclusion that the whole purpose of the Sharia was to protect certain five key spheres of human life and activity. These five areas were included religion, life, property, family, and intellect. And they said that if at any particular time a scholar derives a law that would harm one of those main areas of life, that in fact either that scholar has derived the law incorrectly and needs to go back to the books and search deeper, or there is some exceptional circumstance, so there needs to be an exception to the law. An example of that would be in a contemporary example would be in the area of finance. You know, it's given that one of the main goals of the Sharia is to protect property, we have to look at how it's possible in a contemporary economy to continue to interact with the world financial system. Now, many people think that it's impossible to do that without partaking of the system of credit based on interest, interest-based loans. In fact, historically, Muslim scholars across the world and societies developed different ways of extending credit without using interest as the basis for enrichment. And there's very interesting studies of this in different areas, from China to Central Asia, across North Africa, about how all these different techniques were used to extend credit. In the contemporary world, it's a little bit more complicated because of the dominance of Western financial systems that deal in interest. And so you have certain dilemmas that are set up for, say, Muslims living in the West. What if a family really needs to buy a house, but they can't, you know, they don't have enough money, like most people, you know, don't have enough cash to buy a house outright? What do they do? How do they deal with the question of mortgages? Now, scholars have said in this case, if a family has no other way of purchasing a home, then it may be permissible in their case to take an interest-bearing loan. At the same time, the Muslim community needs to develop systems, alternative systems of extending credit. And in fact, that's what Muslims in North America have done. They founded housing co-ops and other companies that extend credit or that offer a kind of partnership between an individual family and a corporation, a business, so that the family can over time buy a home without paying interest. So those are some of the techniques that are used by scholars to really meet human needs, universal human needs in different circumstances.
Mm-hmm. That's very interesting. You talked a little bit about how the Sharia can be adapted to specific cultures, but I also wanted to ask you how the Sharia historically has dealt with new and different ideas that have come in, scientific discoveries, new philosophies or new theories. Is the Sharia open to accepting these new things? Or?
Sure. Well, if we look at something like medicine, in the medieval period, Muslim scholars, especially in the Arab world, you know, in the Arab part of the Muslim world, were making great advances in the areas of medicine. And in fact, you know, we have the term Renaissance man that we use to identify a person who has facility or knowledge in a number of different disciplines. Well, pre-Renaissance, you found many Muslim scholars who really embodied that kind of universal knowledge. So there were legal scholars who were also medical researchers and writing treatises on different things like the circulation of the blood and ophthalmology and other things. And these discoveries were integrated into Islamic law, and they continue to do so. So that if we look at the different issues, for example, end of life issues, when does life end? And this is very important for when people are dying. And with the development of so much technology that can extend life, it's important to have an understanding of when the end of life is. And so Muslim scholars, in deciding what is the proper Islamic position about permitting support to be withdrawn from a person who is at the end of their life, have used these scientific discoveries to understand that death is defined as brain death, and at that point that life support, for example, can be withdrawn, and that is permissible from an Islamic standpoint.
What we saw in Europe with Galileo's new theories is a real strong resistance from the church. So my question would be, how would the Sharia and the Muslim community react to a Galileo coming in with new philosophies and new theories?
Well, the Muslim world never really had the kind of problem with a clash between science and religion that medieval Europe did. The reason for that is that the Quran itself enjoins human beings to contemplate the earth, to contemplate creation. And in fact, even for the performance of basic Islamic rituals, Muslims had to study science. For example, most people know that Muslims have to face in the direction of Mecca when they pray their five daily prayers. Well, what do you do if you're in Damascus or in Fez in Morocco or in southern Europe, in Andalus, which is now called Spain, and you need to face in the direction of Mecca? You need to be able to find direction scientifically. And so in order to do that, Muslims studied the stars, they calculated distances, and they in fact knew and believed that the world, the globe was round, and calculated it quite exactly before that was acceptable in medieval Europe. So there never really was that suspicion of science among Muslim scholars that or religious leaders that there was in medieval Europe.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to WRPI Troy 91.5 FM. For our listeners out there, if you have any questions for Dr. Mattson or any comments or anything, please feel free to call into the studio. Our phone number here is area code 518-276-6248. And for our online listeners, you can instant message us at the screen name WRPI Studio. Dr. Mattson, I wanted to talk a little bit about the so-called conflict between secularism and Sharia. Do you feel that there's a conflict between these two?
Well, I there can be, depending how you define it. I mean, if secularism means that there's absolutely no presentation of religious belief or symbolism in the public space, like has been the case in Turkey, for example, until recently the situation's changing a little bit, then there can be a problem because Islam requires that people are free to follow their religion, and that's not only Muslims, but it includes people of other faiths as well.
Right, I was going to ask you about that. Two characteristics that secularism is often associated with is freedom of religion and freedom of speech. And I think oftentimes when people hear and study the Sharia, when they hear about the Sharia, they think that this is lacking. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, the American model of secularism is very different from the European model and the Turkish model, for example, where in American society there is a separation of church and state. The state cannot favor a particular religion, but at the same time people are free to practice the religion, and even, political people who have positions of political power are free to express their religious beliefs. I was listening to an interview with Mario Cuomo last night on the radio, and he was talking about how deeply religious he is and how his values clearly influenced his public policy, yet at the same time wasn't imposing his views on other people or using his political office to impose those views. So the American model is quite a good one for Muslims. It's quite in harmony with the Islamic position that that it's God who gave us freedom. I mean, freedom isn't given to us by the government. God created humans differently than other creatures. I mean, there are other creatures on the earth who have even certain kinds of intelligence and emotion, but it's the freedom to choose our belief, our relationship with God that really distinguish us as human beings and gives us the responsibility to for our actions. For that reason, any kind of coercion of one's religious belief is meaningless, because in front of God, that will have no meaning if we simply do something because we're coerced. Now, throughout Islamic history, we saw that indigenous religious communities, different Christian sects, and Jewish communities were given freedom. In fact, they were given so much freedom that they really flourished in those societies, so that in the Middle East today there are Christian denominations that aren't found elsewhere. Some of the oldest Jewish communities are in areas in the Middle East, from Morocco to, in fact, Baghdad until recently. Now, that doesn't mean that at times there hasn't been coercion or that governments always gave those freedoms to everyone. And we do see that at various times throughout history, non-Muslims were oppressed. But usually what you notice is that those same governments were oppressing not only non-Muslims, but their Muslim subjects at the same time. So that these governments were oppressive or totalitarian governments that would use their power unjustly against their citizens and subjects in general, and everyone suffered from that, including non-Muslim subjects.
We just had a question come in, and the question is: in Saudi Arabia, we see that women can't drive. We see that American soldiers cannot wear crosses. How is this related to the Sharia and the freedom of religion you're speaking about?
Mm-hmm. Well, let's first look at Saudi Arabia in the context of the Muslim world, because, first of all, the Muslim world is a very wide part of Asia. I mean, other areas as well, but most Muslims live in Asia and Africa. And across that those two continents, we see a wide diversity in the way governments are organized and the way governments deal with their population. And there's such a legacy from colonialism, from nationalism, that it's really quite a mixed bag. Now, Saudi Arabia has a certain model. It's a very, Saudi Arabia really only became a meaningful country about 50 years ago when oil was discovered, and they started to build the infrastructure of a modern nation state. And it still follows a very tribal kind of society, although there have been many changes in the past decade in particular, so that women have more and more freedom and more access to public space. Even though, a lot of people are surprised to hear that in Saudi Arabia that there's very high literacy, and that, there's women who are professors and doctors and physicians and, all different areas of life, but generally there's been a separation of men and women in public space, although that, as I say, is starting to change a little bit. Similarly, the problem with non-Muslims in Saudi Arabia is the interpretation of what is sacred space in Saudi Arabia. Everyone knows that the cities of Mecca and Medina are considered sacred grounds for Muslims. So just as, for example, Mormons consider their temple as that kind of sacred space that only believers can come to. Traditionally, that's the understanding of Mecca and Medina, that those are sacred places that are for only those who are in that area to practice those rituals and acts of worship as Muslims.
That's similar to the Vatican.
Right. Now, the issue in Saudi Arabia is that after Saudi Arabia was constituted as a nation state with distinct borders, there was a question, well, how much of this area is still sacred and should be exclusive to Muslims and how much shouldn't be? And that's really the problem that they're going through now. But I don't think actually it's a theological problem so much as a political problem, because the Americans that are in Saudi Arabia, by and large, are either people who come temporarily and they really are not interested in integrating very much in Saudi society. They come there to work. They want to maintain their lifestyle on an industrial base, or military, and that's really the problem is the military bases. So that's something that Saudi Arabia still has to work out, but Saudi Arabia certainly is not the model for all of the Muslim world. If you look at the largest Muslim country in the world, which is Indonesia, over 220 million people, there are 5 official religions that are recognized by the Indonesian government. And they're all given, certain amount of, not only are they official religions, but they're also given a certain amount of support by the state to create and run their institutions. And that includes Islam, Hinduism, Buddhism, Protestantism, and Catholicism. They separate the two as two separate religions in Indonesia. So, you know, definitely there are some contradictions in Saudi Arabia, but if we look at other parts of the Muslim world, there's this very different relationship between Muslims and non-Muslims, and the question is, for each country to try to work out a system, a constitutional system, that is really, really fair and just for everyone who's in that country.
Going back to something you said earlier, I was wondering, Dr. Mattson, if you could talk a little bit about how the Sharia or Islamic law regards women, because we see in a lot of Muslim societies today that women have not a very good status. We see that they're limited in education. We see that they're limited from a lot of things that their male counterparts are able to participate in. So is it true that Islamic law regards women to be inferior human beings? And if not, how do you explain restrictions that are put on women, such as their dress code and their lack of education and so forth?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, first we have to have a realistic assessment of the facts. Again, to say that in most of the Muslim world women are in an inferior position is not necessarily true. If we look across the world generally, we see that women have always had struggles, had to struggle for certain rights that men have not. That's true in the United States as anywhere else. If we think about how long ago it is that women were able to vote in this country, own property. I was listening to a program the other day about the Boston Marathon, just slightly over 30 years ago, the first woman ran in the Boston Marathon, and she was tackled by a referee and dragged out of the race because she was a woman, and women weren't allowed to run in it. It's absolutely true that Muslim women throughout history, like women, all other women throughout history, have had to deal with local patriarchy and customs and, different challenges to them. Now, is it any worse in Muslim societies than anywhere else? I don't think so. If you look at it, if you do a fair comparison, say, between a Muslim country that has a certain level of affluence and development with a country that is, has a majority non-Muslims. The United States still has not had a female head of state. The head of state of Indonesia is a woman, as has been the head of state of Bangladesh, Pakistan, Turkey. Morocco has more female lawyers per capita than the United States. Egypt has more female physicians per capita than the United States. So, you know, if we just do a factual survey, it's not necessarily the case. Now, there are some things, some problems that are fairly common to Muslim women that are serious stumbling blocks, and those things do need to be worked on. But, you know, mostly it's a question of local custom that is taken up and used, it's misunderstood to be religion and then used to justify certain practices. For example, if you look at, you know, one of the notorious examples is honor killing, which occurs in particular in places like Jordan and Syria. Well, this is something that has nothing to do with Islamic law or with Sharia. In fact, in those countries in which the honor killing laws were put in on the books, which allowed for a lesser punishment for a male member of the family who killed a female relative because of her having extramarital relations. Those laws were put on the books according to tribal custom, so that it's specifically in the legal code saying that this is a recognition of customary law in opposition to Islamic law. So the struggle is to rid these legal codes of those kind of oppressive customs. When it comes to dress, in most Muslim countries, men and women can dress however they want. I mean, the government has nothing to do with how people dress. That's the reality in almost all Muslim countries in the world. There's only a few countries where the state has feels that it's in their jurisdiction to determine how people dress in public, what's appropriate public dress. And at this point, pretty much that's only Saudi Arabia and Iran. And in those countries, there's a dress code that is for men and women. Men also have to, you know, follow dress according to guidelines that are considered appropriate public dress. But those are the only two countries. In the rest of the countries, you have the, you know, the leaders believing that this is up to the individual, and you'll see a wide variety, or very diverse dress styles in most Muslim countries.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Matson, you mentioned earlier the issue of honor killings, and you mentioned earlier in the program how the Sharia is adaptive to customary law and to culture. So how can these two things be reconciled in the Sharia if, say, for example, a practice like honor killings is part of the culture and the custom of a specific society? How would the person implement Sharia?
Well, the rule for recognizing customary norms as part of the Sharia is that it doesn't contradict any explicit text or ruling of the Sharia. So only those customs that are not in contradiction to the Sharia rules can be recognized as normative. Honor killing is not one of those. And there's that's very clear. We have text from that were written by Syrian scholars in the 13th and 14th century in which the same issue is addressed, in which they say that this is not part of the Sharia and that any man who, you know, kills a female relative will be brought to the court for murder. It's not, you know, this is, Islam doesn't give the right to vigilantism and for individuals to take the law in their own hand or to, you know, create their own law. So that's a very clear principle in the Sharia that custom cannot contradict clear prohibitions in the Sharia.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to WRPI 91.5 FM. This is Window on Islam, and we're speaking with Dr. Matson about Sharia or Islamic law. The phone number here in the studio is area code 518-276-6248. And again, for our online listeners, our AOL screen name is WRPI Studio. We're going to take a short break right now to listen to a song called Nabiyun, and we'll be right back.
Ya
Again, this is Window on Islam, and we're speaking with Dr. Ingrid Mattson about Islamic law or Sharia. We have a question from Huma. Go ahead, Huma.
Hi. I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about what the Islamic law says about war and the rules of engagement in war, and if there are any rules, and like, you know, how exactly Muslims fight wars.
Right, sure. Well, Islamic law developed a theory of legal warfare, similar to what was developed in Europe, according to the doctrine of just warfare, which means that even when one is engaged in a battle against the enemy, that certain limits must be observed. So, for example, civilians cannot be deliberately targeted. Agriculture should not be, agriculture, water, or other natural resources shouldn't be destroyed. That if the enemy does make any indication that they want to negotiate or cease hostilities, that the Muslim army should accept that and stop hostilities and turn to negotiation. So it's very similar. At the same time, there are rules about who can call for war and who should lead the war, so that the kind of vigilantism that we see now in the form of terrorism is prohibited by Islamic law. It's not permitted for any, you know, individual to just go and call for, you know, jihad, and that that's permitted. And that, in fact, according to Islamic law, it's only the legitimate government that has the authority to call for war.
Are these rules of engagement in warfare, speaking of, in reference to jihad? That's a word that we hear a lot of times in popular media today.
Well, jihad, I mean, jihad literally means struggle, and Muslims use the term jihad in all different ways, including to mean, you know, a personal struggle or effort to conquer one's own desires, one's own self, a struggle to achieve some righteous goal. But technically, it also is used in the sense of a just war, a war that is lawful and legal. So Islam is not a pacifist religion in the sense that war can never be resorted to, but it's certainly the last resort. And the Quran very explicitly says that if the enemy inclines towards peace, then you should also incline towards peace. so that as long as there's any chance to avoid war, that should be taken, because the consequences of war are always unknown. I mean, it's never known how long it'll last and how far it will stretch, and certainly innocent people in any war will suffer to some extent.
Thank you, Huma, for your question. On the line, we now have Arsalan from Houston. Go ahead, Arsalan.
Assalamu alaikum. I just wanted to ask you, for Muslim Americans, which comes first, Islamic law or American law? And if your answer is going to be Islamic law, then my follow-up to that is, does that mean that they are being unpatriotic towards their own country?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that this sets up a necessary contradiction. I don't think that there has to be a necessary contradiction between Islamic law and American law. Islamic law says that, according to Islamic law, Muslims have to abide by the law of the land, that is an obligation for them to do that, that you can't, you can't come into a country and on the appearance that you're coming for business or travel or whatever reason, and be deceptive about that and try to hurt the country that you're in. That's called treachery, khiana in Arabic. So that there's not necessarily any contradiction. In the United States, people are free to practice their religion, so that Muslims have been able to even get, according to different state laws, endorsement of the Islamic laws of making food, making meat halal or lawful. Islamic marriage contracts have been recognized as long as they were contracted in accordance with, no contradiction between state law. Now, in some cases, there may be a contradiction between Islamic law and the law of the land, but it depends, it depends how we get at this and understand that our obligations as Muslims and any country as citizens is to follow the law. And just as, for example, Mario Cuomo said that as a Roman Catholic and governor, he would try to bring his beliefs to influence public policy, Muslims can do the same thing. For example, in Islamic law, it is the right of every human being to have access to health care. So that's a public policy matter for which Muslims can lobby. And as long as as long as there are American citizens, innocent people, children who are without health care or who are going hungry, that is against Islamic law, whether those parents are Muslim or not. So it's the obligation then of Muslims to lobby for that, for those policies and for those just laws that fit with our goals and our priorities.
Dr. Manson, just another follow-up that I had to that, and I'm going to link it to a statement that you said earlier about there being no vigilantism in Islam. And what we see in the modern world is a lack of implementation of true Islamic law, even in most of the Muslim countries, if not all. So has the concept or has the existence of Islamic law become more of a utopic notion among Muslims? And if that is the case, then does that mean Sharia really does not exist anymore in today's world? And if so, then is there a desire or a wish among the hearts of Muslims to bring back Islamic law into this world?
Mm-hmm. I think the main problem for Muslims in relation to Islamic law is that Sharia has become a very ideological, almost identity kind of issue, rather than rather than Muslims understanding that Sharia means trying to turn your face towards God, trying to turn your life towards God, trying to achieve, His pleasure by integrating morality and ethics and the goals of the Sharia, and shaping society in accordance with these good values and divine values. Rather than that, what happened in many parts of the Muslim world is that with the invention of nation states across the Muslim world in which law is in the purview of the government, and that it's the state that is enforcing a certain kind of ideological view of life on the people, that we have a real distortion of the Sharia. You know, communism, nationalism, ethnic nationalism, like the kind of things that we see in Syria or in Saddam Hussein's Iraq, you know, the Ba'ath Party, has created a sense that law is about control and about shaping, you know, forcing people to act in a certain way. And that's not what the Sharia is about. The Sharia is more about, creating a society that is nurturing, supportive, certainly guiding people towards a good life, but at the same time not being involved in every aspect of their day-to-day affairs. Because, you know, the thing to remember is that without the right intention, none of this matters. So that if someone's coerced into an action, even if it's the so-called right action, then in fact you don't have the right result. And that's really what we see. And I think I'm very optimistic that more and more Muslims are understanding that, and there are a number of think tanks and organizations and scholars across the world really who are trying to understand the true nature of the Sharia and the relationship between this way of life and between a contemporary society with the needs and demands of a, you know, modern nation state, which, you know, is just the simple political reality that we have to deal with. And, many good ideas are being developed in policies by these scholars and different think tanks. So I'm quite confident that we're moving in the right direction. Although up to now, it's been a bit of a rocky road because, as everyone knows, unfortunately, some of these nation states basically reduced Sharia to criminal law. They forgot about everything else and then just looked for the most, the absolute punishment, that part of the Sharia, and decided to impose them and neglected every other aspect of the law. And that really has created a lot of problems for, let's say, the reputation of the Sharia as just a harsh legal code.
Thank you, Arsalan, for your question. We have about 8 minutes left in the program, so once again, our phone number here in the studio is area code 518-276-6248, and we're going to try to squeeze in as many questions as we can in these last few minutes. Dr. Mattson, just to address some of the things that you just mentioned, we hear a lot in the media today about Amina Nowell from Nigeria and how she was found guilty for adultery after having a child 2 years after her divorce. I was wondering if you could maybe address this.
Yeah, this is a real tragedy. You know, Nigeria is, first of all, Nigeria is one of the most corrupt, governments in the world, so that there's all sorts of injustices that are being done against the people in Nigeria. Second, unfortunately, Nigerians in the north have had exposure to a certain kind of more rigid way of interpreting Islamic law that has been imported from other parts of the Muslim world in recent years, because certain countries that had funding established schools in northern Nigeria that introduced a kind of methodology and approach to Islamic law that is not indigenous to Nigeria or West Africa. And so that's one problem. In the specific case of this woman, in fact, according to Islamic law, she's not liable for this punishment because there are so many mitigating circumstances. For example, in the Sharia, if a woman claims that she's been raped was forced to have intercourse, that claim in itself frees her from any obligation or any responsibility for the consequences of that action. And there's many other particular details about the case that that show that it's just very, very political. For example, it was a kind of local bureaucrat who decided to further his career by making this a big issue and showing that he was tough on crime. And, you know, I think we're very familiar with that in the United States, that there are certain politicians who like to, you know, improve their standing in a community that's worried about insecurity and, you know, values in society are going downhill. And so they make their career on the back of poor people who, you know, are already suffering. You know, we've seen that in this country with people who have gotten 50-year sentences for petty theft, for example, because it was their third time they were convicted of theft. So this is an unfortunate reality in Nigeria and in some other parts of the world. And, you know, the solution is not, as anyone knows, law, of course, affects morality, but you cannot change society without giving people their rights and the kind of support, education, and you know, serving their basic needs in order to put them in a position where they can actually make meaningful choices in their lives.
Dr. Manson, sorry to cut you off a little bit. We just have a few more questions that I want to squeeze in here at the end of the program. This question is from Ridwan from New York City via the internet, and he asks, is it possible for the Sharia to be implemented in a modern-day country like the U.S.?
Well, I mean, I don't know. I don't think the U.S. is the only modern-day country. I mean, there are a lot of countries in the world that have majority Muslim populations, and if that's their desire to have their laws in accordance with the Sharia, there's no reason why that can't be done. I mean, people should not have a legal system imposed on them that doesn't, you know, that they don't agree to, especially Sharia, because it is based on one's desire to, you know, to please God. But every legal system, I mean, every person is born into a particular legal system, and they don't have, you know, they can't just chuck that legal system out and bring a new one in and say, well, I'm not going to have, you know, an American, someone who's born in the United States can't say, well, I'm not going to have American law applied to me because I want to follow Chinese law. As long as you live in America, you have that law applied on you, and then you try to shape and change the law if you believe that it's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the same thing for Muslims.
We also have a question that's correlated with this from Amal from Knoxville. She asks, what does Sharia say about professional ethics? If you could just answer this in about the minute or so we have left in the program.
Professional ethics? Well, I assume that to mean is that certainly the Sharia requires people to stand by their contracts, to stand by their words. In fact, there's a saying of the Prophet Muhammad that Muslims are known by their contractual obligations, so that's a very, very important part of Islamic law, is to fulfill the terms of a contract, also to be very to be honest and forthright. So for example, if you're selling a car, it's part of Islamic law to show the defects and to tell the buyer about possible defects, so that This is all part of Sharia, is your behavior in all parts of life, including in your professional life.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Matson, in the last minute or so of the program, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the program that's happening at the College of St. Rose on Wednesday. You're actually coming to the area, and I'm looking at the pamphlet right now. The title of the program is Islamic Law in the Modern World. What are you going to be speaking about during this program?
Well, it's because it's a general audience, mostly of clergy and other religious leaders as well as academics. I want to give an overview of Islamic law, of the Sharia, and also talk about some of the challenges that Muslims face in our contemporary life and trying to really live up to the spirit and demands of this sacred law, and our desire to try to, you know, please God in all aspects of our lives.
And once again, for our listeners, this program is at 7 p.m. this Wednesday at the Hubbard Interfaith Sanctuary in St. Rose College. Thank you, Dr. Mattson, for being with us on the program. We're very honored to have you, and I think you gave us some really good insight about Sharia and some of its workings.
Well, you're welcome. Thank you very much, Shazia.